Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books across a broad range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Stephen Yablo, Professor of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His new book, Aboutness, is just out from Princeton University Press. A day after Yablo bought his daughter Zina ice cream for her birthday, Zina complained, "You never take me for ice cream anymore." Yablo, like most of us, initially responded that this was obviously false. But he also thought that Zina said something true about their regular activity of going for ice cream, and that she expressed this truth by saying something false. This phenomenon is common in ordinary conversation, but it's quite strange from a standard view of semantics, according to which Zina's statement would have a truth condition, and if the truth condition isn't met, the sentence is false, and that's the end of it. Yablo argues instead that this sort of example reveals an aspect of semantics that standard views are inadequate to capture, the fact that sentences are about subject matters, and that their subject matters may be constrained by, but are not determined by, their truth conditions. Moreover, it may be that there is no other way to say some truths than by using falsehoods to say them. In Aboutness, Yablo explores this linguistic phenomenon and defends the idea that we often go beyond what we want to say and then subtract from the whole of what is said to the part that we really care about, its subject matter. Let's tune in to the interview. Stephen Yablo, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for inviting me, Carrie.
I am really happy to be talking to you about your new book, Aboutness. And this is, as you note in the introduction, a study in philosophical semantics regarding what sentences are about, which is not their truth conditions, but what you call their subject matter. And so it's a not unconventional look at how we think about meaning and semantics, in which, as you put it, we will often say truths that come wrapped up in falsehoods. So let me, to kind of get us started, maybe you can say something about how you came to this subject, maybe in general, if coming to philosophy of language, and then how you came to the topic of this book in particular.
Let's see. Well, there's a kind of creation myth for the book, which I should probably relate. It's sort of true, which is my daughter, Zina, complaining you never take me to Friendly's for ice cream anymore. And am I pointing out that I'd taken her the day before with her friends on her birthday? And her reply was, I wasn't talking about that, which struck me as a pretty lame reply at the time. But then the more I thought of it, the more it seemed to me that this is really an important part of communication and how we express ourselves, that we sort of don't just say things, we direct what we're saying to certain subject matters, and we hold them, our statements, answerable only to what they say about that subject matter. And the way I came up against this issue, I guess, way back when, was in philosophy of mathematics. I was one of the many people interested in the possibility that, you know, numbers and functions were playing an instrumental role in mathematical physics, and that you shouldn't, as Quine tries to act as though the physicist is, you know, giving us her word for it, that there are functions, as opposed to just using functions to convey something about the physical world. Uh-huh. And there's that word about, so the idea was to take that really seriously and to say there is a subject matter of the physical world. You can say the number of, the rate of star formation is exponentially declining. That makes reference to mathematical objects, but you weren't talking about mathematical objects, you were talking with them. Mm-hmm. And so it was in the service of something like anti-Platonism in the philosophy of mathematics originally. Yeah.
Okay. Huh. So maybe you could say a little bit, you give some nice examples of aboutness. I mean, that was one, but maybe, you know, when I was thinking about the book, I thought of Toni Morrison when she's called President Bill Clinton our first black president. And that struck me, and maybe not you, but as an example of somebody expressing something, talking about Bill Clinton, but saying with a sentence that is like patently false about him. Is that type of thing a good example of the sort of phenomenon that you are trying to get at?
I would so love it if it was. I'm not sure it is, but the I can sort of just think out loud about it and maybe. Well, actually, let me give you another political example first, and then I'll come back to it.
Okay, that's,
that's
fine.
All right.
Yeah.
So this is an example from the 1980 presidential debates, Mondale versus Reagan.
Uh-huh.
And Reagan had been making a lot of misstatements on the stump, and at a certain point, a reporter asked him something about Valérie Giscard d'Estaing, and he said, I don't believe I've heard that name. It was the president of France. And so Reagan came into this debate with sort of reputation for having strong opinions about things he didn't really know that much about. And the moderator asked Mondale, doesn't it bother you that your opponent here knows so little about world affairs? And Mondale answered, well, it's not what he doesn't know what bothers me. It's what he does know that just isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that the concern was more that Reagan thought he knew things that weren't in fact true. Well, this whole idea of knowing things that aren't in fact true, it seems to philosophers like a contradiction, because it's a basic fact about knowledge that only truths can be known. But you can still sort of see what Mondale was getting at. He was talking about what you might think of as like the part of knowledge that concerns sort of confidence and the feeling that you know. And so he wanted his Reagan knows things that aren't true statement to be understood as sort of addressed to the subject matter of kind of confident feelings of knowing, not necessarily knowing itself. I hope that treading water on that for a minute would give me an idea about the Toni Morrison case. But I suppose first black president, I mean, the kind of thing that you would try to do, and I perhaps, if you could tell me, perhaps that it doesn't work well, so I'll be instructive, would be to say, well, in calling Clinton the first black president, you might not be speaking entirely about him, but about his reception in the black community and about his ability to make people understood, to make people feel understood. and his sort of like kind of familiarity with the communities that he was dealing with. And so one could imagine that the statement wasn't really true. Of course, he wasn't black, but it's true about his presentation or about his reception or something of that nature. And that's about as far as I'm prepared to speculate about that.
Okay. Well, one of the key concepts in the book that you talk about is that of partial truth. And that's kind of critical. And so maybe you can describe what that is. I mean, it's you describe it at one point as when there's a gap between the subject matter, what it's about, and what we might call the conventional truth conditions. So could you say a bit about partial truth, first of all?
Yeah, well, so a typical philosophical problem has the following form. There's certain things that we really want to see. They seem completely right to us, and that we would be missing something important if we couldn't say them. Things like, you know, Pegasus does not exist. But on the other hand, although they seem right and we want to say them, we can't figure out how to make them true, because in that case, you know, without Pegasus to serve as subject matter, it's not clear what the sentence is going to be about. And so partial truth is kind of made for this situation. You've got these claims that you want to hold on to. People don't want to give them up. They can't figure out how to make them true. So there's lots of different ways of dealing with this. There's error theory, and there's fictionalism and metaphoricalism and so many other things of that kind. But this is kind of a new way to do it that's sort of more conservative. You're saying, look, maybe the sentence seemed true because it's true about what we were talking about. So we didn't even notice it wasn't completely true. It's like if I were to say the astronauts, when they went to the moon, they landed over by the left eyebrow of the man in the moon. You might, you know, not think to yourself, well, that can't be right. There is no man in the moon. You understand that this is a situation where, that probably is an example for later on, now that I think about it. So the here would be a typical example.
Okay.
Yeah. So you know, if you ask someone their height, they'll usually give you a precise number.
Yeah.
5'7". And there's this worry that might occur to you, which is, well, I'm not exactly 5'7". I mean, I'm a little bit less or a little bit more. So how do I get away with saying this? And a lot of semanticists have tried to find ways to get 5'7" to mean something else, like between 5'6.5" and 5'7.5".
Mm-hmm.
But a much easier way to approach this is to say, look, the sentence wasn't really being put forward as true full stop. It was being put forward as true about height to the nearest inch. It was true about my height to the nearest inch, say that I'm 5'7". And it's a great way of conveying precise height information imprecisely to say that it's true about one of these sort of roughened or coarsened subject matters. And of course, as the conversation proceeds, you might say, oh, well, I'm 5'8.25". And then that will signal to me that you're actually talking about a more fine-grained subject matter than I had meant to be addressing. And then I'll take back maybe my claim that I'm 5'7", because I'm a little bit more than a quarter of an inch away from that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this constant sort of jockeying for, like, what are we going to be talking about and what standards will our statements be held to, which is a pretty common part of pragmatics anyway. But this is just a particular theory of how to understand the standards that statements are held to. It's a standard of being true about a certain matter. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, one of the pragmatics, I mean, that you just mentioned, I mean, you know, one of the old, so if we take traditional semantics, you know, or at least mainstream, to be truth conditional, where the meaning of a word is just, you know, composed from the meanings of its parts, and those each have their own kind of atomistic meaning that they carry from context to context. And then this sort of alternative, you know, more pragmatic semantics or relevance theory tries to get away from that and say, no, you know, the meaning is really highly contextually determined. And within that newer tradition, this idea that, you know, when you say 5'7", you know, I don't mean that I'm 5'7". I'm talking about some property that's actually a bit more vague than that. How do you see that? How do you see your approach in relation to the relevance theoretic idea that, you know, what we say just, you know, sort of what's lexically encoded, right, in any particular word or sentence, doesn't determine a lot of what is actually being expressed.
Yeah. So actually, that's an interesting question given the example that I gave, because one of the sort of founding papers of relevance theory was this paper by Sperber and Wilson called Loose Talk,
right,
where they sort of give examples like where you say what somebody's height is or where somebody lives in Paris for certain purposes but not for other purposes. And what they say has a certain kind of similarity to what I say. They say, well, look, sometimes you might make a statement not because it's correct itself, but because it has so many correct consequences. And as long as you can sort of get people to realize that it's only the consequences that you're speaking up for or advocating for, there's a tremendous economy of expression. And so to the extent that relevance has to do with economy of expression and using a little to say a lot and so forth, there is a bit of a connection with my stuff on partial truth. I guess the way to say it is this. Relevance theorists try to explain like a huge mass of fascinating phenomena. They do it with processes that are sometimes well understood and sometimes are just sort of schemas for processes. There's things like free enrichment where
right. You
just sort of build something up according to some plan that isn't really stated, and it's not always obvious why you can reach this by free enrichment, but you can't reach that.
Those
ground rules are a little bit unclear. So what I'm trying to do is get at least some portion of the goods that I suppose truth conditional pragmatics people get, but using something much closer to sort of conventional means.
Okay.
That was
very helpful. So back to the question about partial truth, because this, you know, your discussion of this, you know, goes through a number of chapters. You go through what are true parts? How do they confer partial truth on the wholes, the sentences that they are part of? And you also suggest the very interesting idea that there are actually some truths that we can't express except by uttering falsehoods, and that thought is part of what motivates this idea of partial truth. Hmm. So could you tell us a bit about those, you know, details about partial truth?
Yeah. Well, let me actually go back a tiny bit to how the notion of partial truth relates to this other notion, which is the notion just of a part, because the idea that I sort of start with is that of all a statement's implications, I mean, we usually treat statement's implications as like it's just a sort of homogeneous body of things implied by the statement. But I tend to think that there's a difference between what you might call a consequence, savor the full meaning of that word, something that comes after the statement, you know, something that if once you've got the statement, then this is brought along of necessity. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other thing, which you might call a presequence, which is something that already had to be true before the statement could be true. So a consequence of snow is white might be snow is white or expensive. It's not as though you first have to establish that at least snow is white or expensive before you can make your way to snow is white. That just doesn't ever come up. Whereas if you have a sentence like snow is white and cold, it has the consequence that snow is white. But this is not, so to speak, logically downwind from snow is white and cold. It's something that better already be on board before you're in a position to say that snow is white and cold. So I'm interested in, I want to divide implications of a statement between those that sort of come after the statement and those that already had to be there before, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's the ones that already had to be there before that I call parts.
Okay.
And so a conjunct would be a paradigm part or an instance of a generalization. And then one of the tests for whether something is a part is ask yourself, if it were true, would that reflect back favorably on the whole? So if I say snow is white and expensive, well, part of that might be snow is white. How do I determine that that really is a part? Well, if snow is white, then that seems to confer some kind of truth, what I call partial truth, on snow is white and expensive. It gets something right. Whereas if I take, say snow is expensive, that implies snow is expensive or white. That implication is true because snow is white. But I don't say, oh, well, I guess snow is expensive got something right, namely that it's expensive or white. Because when I say snow is expensive, I'm not saying in part this random disjunctive consequence. Whereas when I make a conjunctive claim, I am saying in part the conjuncts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, are there see, once you're working with conjunction and disjunction, it's easier, I think, to think about parts because you're already, you know, constructing a sentence
yeah.
from simpler sentences or simpler predicates. And I was thinking, is there an example where it's a simple sentence, you know, atomic sentence, like, I don't know, you used before, you know, Pegasus. Pegasus has wings. I mean, you didn't say that. I just did. What would be the partial truth in that?
Let me start with a simpler example, the philosophy of math example that I mentioned before. So there might be, you know, scientists might discover that there's like a certain ratio between planets and stars. You know, they say there's 1.73 planets for every star.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, let me simpler one. There's 1.5 planets for every star.
Mm-hmm.
So that's you're saying, you know, this over this is 1.5. There's a part that's, and of course 1.5 is a number, so the statement seems to be partly about mathematical entities, which wasn't what we were intending to be giving information about. And so the thought would be, when you say the number of planets divided by the number of stars is 1.5, there's a part of that that's just about the stars and planets, and it goes roughly like this. There are 3 planets and 2 stars, or there are 6 planets and 4 stars, or there are, etc., all the ways in which you could have 1.5 times as many stars and planets. And if you write that kind of thing out logically, there's no occurrence of number words anymore. You can just write that with first order quantifiers. And so here's a way to picture it. So a statement is true about a subject matter. Subject matter, which I didn't say yet, is kind of understood as something like a relation between worlds. The relation that one world bears to another if they're kind of just the same mm-hmm. with respect to that subject matter. So the subject matter of the number of stars is a relation that obtains between two worlds if they have equally many stars. And the way you should think about truth about a certain subject matter is, here's this statement. It's false in this world, but could you make it true by morphing the world in a way that left it unchanged with respect to that subject matter? Is there an equivalent world
mm-hmm.
where it's really true. So suppose this is a nominalistic world, and I say the ratio of planets to stars is 1.5. That's false, because there is no 1.5. But is it false because of how many stars and planets there are? Well, the test would be, could you have a world that was just like our world with regard to how many stars and planets there were, but where it really was true that the ratio is 1.5? And the answer is supposed to be, well, yes, all you would have to do is sort of add numbers to the world. If you add numbers off to the side, then you can use them to count the objects. And now it becomes really true that the number of stars planets divided by the number of stars is 1.5. That's not the most interesting example from your point of view. I haven't forgot about that, and I'll come to some more interesting ones in a minute. But that's the basic picture. A is true about subject, sentence A is true about subject matter M. If A could be true compatibly with how matters stand with respect to M. Mm-hmm. A is false, but not because of the world's M condition. The world's M condition is not the problem. What are some other examples? So, one that I give, this is leading up to the non-existence cases. This is an old puzzle of Geech's, the hob-nob puzzle, mm-hmm. Where there's these two farmers, Hob and Nob, and Hob thinks a witch burned down his barn, and Nob thinks she, that same witch, blighted his mare. And the problem here is, on the one hand, that can't be right because there is no witch. It can't be right if you were trying to sort of quantify over the witches on the outside. You can't analyze it as there is an X, such that X is a witch who burned down Nob's barn and then blighted Hob's nair. But the thing is that in order to have the sort of what Geech calls the common focus between Nob's beliefs and Hob's beliefs, it seems like you need a single thing that they're both thinking about. But that would be, again, the existential quantifier on the outside that we can't have. So on the one hand, we need an existential quantifier on the outside to get Hob and Nob, to get the part of Hob and Nob's story whereby they're thinking about the same thing, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But we can't have it because there is no same thing that they're thinking about. So this is one case where we might try to use partial truth as follows. You say, look, that statement was not entirely true because it involves there being a witch and there wasn't a witch. But let's look at the part of the world that begins just after the witch was supposed to have done the initial deed. So a fire did start in the barn, which Hob blamed on the witch. Let's leave out the moment where the fire was started and just look at the fire and everything after. The claim is that the Hobnob statement could be true about the fire and everything after. In other words, our world could be one that differs from a world where it really is true that Hob thought a witch burned down his barn and Nob thought she blighted his mare. Where the only difference between those two is that we add a witch at the beginning before the fire in the other world. In other words, the only obstacle, so to speak, to the literal truth of the Hobnob statement is that there was no witch at the beginning. Well, there was no witch at the beginning, so we're stuck. We can't make it true in our world, but we can at least convey that it was true about events since the witch, the alleged witch in our world, by pointing out that we could make it really true by just installing a witch right before the fire, starting the fire.
Let me just ask a question, because one of the things that, the various examples you've been giving have all involved, objects or putative objects, I should say, in the case of numbers, or a witch or Pegasus or, that kind of a thing. And so one of the thoughts that I had when I was reading the book was about states of affairs, things that are wider, bigger, or in some sense, just more encompassing than objects. Mm-hmm. And, just a very general question in terms of the metaphysics of what it is that subject matters are. You don't really introduce states of affairs. And they seem to be they seem to be something that would be part of the mix in terms of subject matters. So do you leave them out for any reason, or do you leave them out at all?
So tell me if this is what you're asking. So the examples that I gave so far of partial truth, the false bit that had to be taken away involved, not every example, but some of them involved the existence of something, mm-hmm. like numbers in the one case or the witch mm-hmm. in another case. And so I didn't, except for the loose talk example, do much to indicate how it would work if you were abstracting away in a non-ontological dimension. Mm-hmm. And so I could give examples like that if you wanted, or I could tell you how something like states of affairs just sort of figures in the mechanics of it.
I think the latter is more what I'm interested in.
Yeah. So David Lewis had a theory of subject matters way back when, and he introduced a notion. I mean, they were entities in their own right, like the number of stars was a subject matter, or what I did last summer would be a subject matter. Mm-hmm. And they correspond roughly to sort of ways of carving up logical space according to the different numbers of stars, different things I did last summer. He then had to bring sentences into the picture. I'm working up to states of affairs mm-hmm. or facts. He then had to bring sentences into the picture, and he said the following. He said, a sentence is wholly about a subject matter if its truth value supervenes on how matters stand with respect to that subject matter or where that subject matter is concerned. Mm-hmm. So the number of stars as prime is wholly about how many stars there are, because if you fix how many stars there are, then there's no further variation possible in whether the number is prime or not. Mm-hmm. And the problem he came up with was that, well, that sounds fine in that case. It's in the nature of sort of supervenience claims that if you expand the base, then you still get supervenience. So not only is, say, the number of stars as prime wholly about the number of stars, it's also about the number of stars and how many cats there are, and the number of stars and what I did last summer. It's also about how everything is in every respect whatsoever, like mm-hmm. the maximal subject matter. Mm-hmm. And that seems bad.
Yeah.
So it seemed like Lewis has got a sort of a one-many relation between sentences and subject matters. There's a whole lot of subject matters that they're wholly about. And so my diagnosis of this was that when you say that a sentence is wholly about a subject matter, you could read the wholly as playing one of two roles. The first is there's nothing in the sentence that isn't addressed by that subject matter. So the subject matter is, so to speak, big enough to handle all the factors that are pertinent to the truth of the sentence. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you might mean is there's nothing in the subject matter that is irrelevant to the truth of the sentence. In other words, the one thing is the subject matter has an all you need to figure out whether the sentence is true. The one he misses is it has only that. It only addresses issues that are relevant to how and why the sentence is true. And this, so you could put it like this. Here's how I think of the subject matter of a sentence. It's like just as you have the notion of like whether a sentence is true, mm-hmm. you can have the notion of how it's true. A disjunctive sentence might be true by way of its first disjunct or its second disjunct, or maybe even the both together. Now I'm coming up to states of affairs. So what is this notion of how a sentence is true? Well, it's fairly close to what people talk to under the heading of truth makers.
Right.
There's supposed to be various particular constellations of events in the world that are singled out as peculiarly relevant to how and why a sentence is true. So one way that you could state, so one way I like to think of subject matters is kind of, you look at a great big map of logical space, and there's sort of contour lines in the map that are sort of showing you when things are changing with regard to how the sentences are true. But another way to think of it is just as subject matter of a sentence just is the set of its truth makers. It's all the different reasons the sentence could have for being true, where you don't add in extra stuff, which is not really relevant to. So if the sentence is Sparky, that's my dog, has a friend, mm-hmm. one truth maker would be Jazz is Sparky's friend. It's another dog. Mm-hmm. But here would not be. Jazz is Sparky's friend and sleeping right now. That would not be a truth maker for Sparky has a friend, because it has this extra junk in it, sleeping right now, mm-hmm. that's of no relevance to how it is that Sparky has a friend. So there's some notion of proportionality. You want to find a state of affairs that sort of contains all of what you need, but no more than what you need to say how a particular world contrives to make a sentence true.
Okay, so then how do we, how do we narrow down the subject matter so that it has just one? How do we hone in on the one that we want?
Yeah, well, so that becomes the question of, you know, what are the different ways a sentence can be true? And there's two answers to how we do that. One is we kind of postulate that it's done and then apply it in a bunch of different areas and then see what the requirements of those different applications are for how you do it. And so I'm somewhat open to that possibility. There might be different ways of doing it for different issues. Mm-hmm. So for some issues, you want logically equivalent sentences to have different subject matters. For other issues, you might not. So if you're interested, say, this is one of the applications in the book, in the verisimilitude, which is this concept introduced by Popper, thought all scientific theories were false, but nevertheless, they were getting closer to the truth, or they might get closer to the truth. And verisimilitude was his word for the quantity that increases as they get closer to the truth. You might think that logically equivalent sentences should agree in verisimilitude. And so for that application, you want their truth makers to be the same if you're going to be using truth makers and subject matter in your account of verisimilitude. But there are other kinds of applications where, conversational implicature, where you actually want to have differences. So, for example, here's a puzzling phenomenon. If I say, someone asks me what I had for dessert, I say, I had cake or pie, that normally is taken to suggest that I didn't have both. Mm-hmm. But here's what's odd. Equivalent to having cake or pie is having cake or pie or both. The truth tables are just the same because it's an inclusive or. Mm-hmm. So, but if I say I had cake or pie or both, I'm no longer implicating that I didn't have both. So there's these two logically equivalent sentences, P or Q, P or Q or P and Q, that differ in their implicatures. And you can explain that somewhat in terms of truth makers. I'm just going to assert that. And then you want to have a separate truth maker for the conjunction in the case of P or Q or P and Q. If you're interested in the problem of like logical omniscience, you might want to say that, P or not P is true for one reason and Q or not Q is true for another reason. Different logical truths will have their own reasons for being true, stemming from their sort of compositional structure and the ways that their atoms become true. And failure to recognize logical equivalences could come from the fact that you can't quite work out whether the exact set of facts you need to make this sentence true is the same set of facts that you need to make the other sentence true. But that requires that truth makers are cut more finely than logical equivalents. Anyway, there's a bunch of different examples in the book of where you might and where you might not. So confirmation paradoxes, for instance, I would want to say that the truth makers for, you know, all ravens are black are different from the truth makers for all non-black things are non-ravens.
Mm-hmm.
And this connects up with the idea that their subject matter is different, which connects up with the idea that their parts are different. So it might be part of all ravens are black that this particular specimen here, Rudy the Raven, is black. But it's not part of all non-black things are non-ravens that this particular raven here, Rudy, is black. And this is supposed to help with the problem of the paradox of confirmation, because oftentimes when we're interested in inductive confirmation, we want our evidence not just to make the hypothesis more probable as a whole, but we want it to sort of pervasively probabilify the hypothesis. In other words, that if I find a black raven, this is a point that Goodman made, I don't just want to say, oh, well, at least here's one raven that isn't a counterexample to all ravens are black. I want to be able to increase my expectation that the next raven I find will be black as well.
Mm-hmm.
So inductive confirmation basically is probabilifying not just a statement, but also all of its parts. So if you have logically equivalent statements that differ in subject matter figures in the definition of parts, they differ in their parts, that would explain how their confirmation relations could be different, even though they're logically equivalent. So I'll say it one more time. All ravens are black. All non-black things are non-ravens.
Right.
They're logically equivalent. The first is about ravens. The second is about non-black things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The parts depend on what they're about. Mm-hmm. The parts figure in the confirmation relations if it's inductive confirmation. And so that's why the differences in aboutness can affect their confirmation properties. Yeah.
And let me just to... I hope this is not a bad question, but so truth makers and subject matters have to be distinguished.
There's several notions of truth makers flying about. It's
true,
just an unusual one.
Okay.
So usually people talk about truth makers sort of in metaphysics, and they try to evaluate metaphysical theories on the basis of whether you can find facts in the world that would decide whether the relevant kind of sentence would be true. This is a completely semantic application of truth maker.
Okay.
So it's sort of like, I'm interested more in, you can think of truth makers in this setting less as sort of the prior things that make a sentence true, as sort of its different ways of being true. So one way for, you know, there are dogs to be true is for Sparky to be a dog. Another way is for Jazz to be a dog.
Yeah.
So these aren't facts on a different, like, metaphysical level. They're just sort of, just as there's different, this might be misleading, but just as there's different ways of, you know, swimming, the backstroke, the crawl, and so on and so forth, there's different ways that can be true that you're swimming. One way is you're doing the backstroke. One is you're doing the crawl. These truth makers are kind of like that. They're kind of semantical in nature, and that kind of suits them for use in a theory of subject matter, the hope is. So the subject matter just becomes really the set of truth makers and ultimately the set of false makers as well.
Okay, so later on in the book you get to the concept of a content part and an inclusion relation for content parts. And you use a principle that you call the upward difference principle. So maybe you could explain what that part of the book is about.
Yeah. Okay. I actually got into some trouble about this recently, so I'm going to try to steer around the trouble. So the thought was this, you know, I define something as a notion of part. I call it content part or logical part. I didn't so far consider the question of whether it's rightly so called, you know, whether that's a good name for it. What does it have in common with other notions of part that we're more familiar with, like material part, or maybe David Lewis's notion that a set is part of its supersets, the ones it's contained in. And so this upward difference transmission principle was an attempt to find a sort of thread that went through all the different notions of part, mm-hmm. some of them extensional, some of them intentional. The idea was this. So one way to think about a material part, say, why are the handlebars part of the bicycle? Well, if you were to change the handlebars intrinsically, like by, say, heating them up, you would then have changed the bicycle intrinsically too. The bicycle can't stay intrinsically just the same while its handlebars are being heated up just because they're part of the bicycle. So that's what I call upward difference transmission. You change the handlebars, you change the bicycle. You can't change the handlebars and leave the bicycle as is, and that's supposed to be closely tied up with why we think of the handlebars as part of the bike.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make some sense? Or?
It does. I'm not sure I entirely agree, but keep going.
Well, I wasn't going for that.
I was going to say, if you know, if one atom, you know, started moving more quickly in the void, an atom that we would consider to be a part of the bicycle, and yet nothing would happen to the bicycle as a whole, we might, you know, I mean, that's not going to be why we think of it as a part of the bicycle. The fact that we can change its behavior without changing anything about the bike itself, the whole bike.
Yeah, I guess there are two ways you could, that's a good example. There are two ways you could go on that. One is just to say, well, I'm talking about any kind of change on the part of the bicycle. And this is, you know, not one that would attract anyone's attention, but it is a change. But another thing that this is something I'm somewhat attracted to, is to say, well, look, you know, the particle is in the bicycle, but it's not a part of the bicycle. You know, for the same reason that, like, my heart is in me, you know, I'm on the faculty at MIT, but my heart is not on the faculty at MIT. So it might be that there's different sort of levels.
Yeah.
So, you know, where your parts have to be somewhat at your level. They shouldn't be at a lower level of reality.
Right.
There's just different ways of talking about it, I guess.
Right. Right.
Okay. So, let's now try to apply that kind of notion. I'm creeping up on the notion of content part. Let's try to apply that to Lewis's idea that a smaller set is part of a bigger set, like the set of even numbers is part of the set of natural numbers. And the thought here would be, it's not that easy to make sense of, is if A is a subset of B, then if I switch a member of A out for another object, then I will have switched the membership of B as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, all the members of A count into the membership of B. Then I switch to something, I try something like property inclusion. So why is red and square, why does that property include the property of being red? Or why does the property of being a vixen include that of being a fox? And here what propagates up is the way in which these properties are possessed. So if something becomes, so fox is part of vixen, because if something becomes, comes to be a fox in a different way. So if you imagine it, I don't know exactly what a different way of being a fox would be, but you could imagine it, say, becoming a twin fox as opposed to sort of a monozygotic fox, then that would change the kind of vixen it is as well. A better example is this. Charge is part of, in a sort of intensive sense, part of positive charge. If a thing changes in charge from 1 to 3, then its positive charge can't stay the same. It has to change how it's positively charged when it changes how it's charged, supposing that it is positively charged. And then it's supposed to finally apply to the idea of content part. The way I officially define it is, you know, A includes B if A implies B. So the argument A therefore B is truth preserving, but it's also aboutness preserving in the sense that the subject matter of B is contained in the subject matter of A. And given the way subject matter is defined in terms of truth maker, that winds up being pretty much the same as saying B is part of A. If you can't wiggle how B is true in a world without wiggling how A is true in that world.
Mm-hmm. But not a causal wiggle.
Right, right. Not a causal wiggle, sort of a manner wiggle.
Okay.
The manner of its truth, yeah.
Okay. Once you have your content parts, then you talk about subtraction. This is another important relationship, that you go into from the idea of expressing, getting at a subject matter by expressing something. And then, as you put it, I think you put it, you're sort of dialing back in some way, subtracting from maybe some formal truth conditional way of interpreting the sentence to what it is about. So could you explain the subtraction relation and its relation to content parts?
Yeah. So this is something that sort of comes up unacknowledged in philosophy a lot. Someone will define X and say, well, it's just like Y, except abstract away from that aspect of Y. So if I were going to explain to you, say, what scare quotes courageous behavior was, I would say, well, it's courageous behavior, but scrap the part about it being thereby admirable or good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's the descriptive component, so to speak, of courageousness. If Chalmers somewhere defines a judgment as a judgment that P is a belief that P, stripped of any phenomenal implications, mm-hmm. What it's like to enjoy and to have the belief. Wittgenstein probably has the most famous example. He says, what is left over if you subtract from a man's raising his arm the fact that his arm went up? Mm-hmm. And the suggestion seems to be, maybe it wasn't what he thought, but people have taken it that way, that, well, that's how you get intentions. That's right. Where intentions come from.
Right.
Yeah. And these are very treacherous waters, because you can't just assume that whenever A implies B, there's something meaningful left when you subtract B from A. So, scarlet implies red, but if I said, well, let's scratch the red part. What does scarlet, so to speak, add to red? What's the extra bit? And it's very, very hard to say. What scarlet adds to red kind of presupposes redness. There isn't like a separable sliver that you can say, well, you take that sliver and then you add it to redness and you get scarlet. Mm-hmm. There's this joke that I told in the book that kind of captures it pretty well, where somebody asks, I think it was supposed to be Einstein in the story, how the telegraph system works. And he says, oh, well, it's just like this. Imagine there's a big dog and its head is in Minsk and its tail is in Pinsk, and you pull the tail in Minsk and it barks in Pinsk. And the guy says, okay, I get that. What about the wireless telegraph? How does that work? And Einstein supposedly says, it's the same way except without the dog. And that feeling of like, well, wait a minute, I don't have any foothold left here if I take away the dog, is one that I think philosophers should have more often than they do. Mm-hmm. They kind of often tend to assume you can just subtract things away. And so you find, like, say, Shoemaker and Parfit, and giving sort of Neo-Lockean theory of personal identity, will say, well, you can't define it in terms of memory, because as Reed said, or Butler, or one of those guys, memory presupposes identity, and so it can't be used to define it. They say, okay, we'll just have a thing, quasi-memory, which is just like identity, quasi-memory, which is just like memory, except the rememberer and the rememberee don't have to be identical.
Right.
And it's sort of assumed that we kind of know how to carve that part off and what is going to be.
Well, this comes up in certainly philosophy of mind with narrow content.
Yes.
And I think Kim, trying to think of an example from that Kim uses it with knowing, sort of the difference between knowledge and belief, probably, is something along these lines.
Yes.
Where a belief state is a knowledge state. A belief state is a knowledge state minus the, you know, external part or something like that.
Right. There have been a number of moves along those lines. The one I was thinking of is Plantinga says somewhere that warrant is what knowledge adds to belief. Something like that.
Yeah.
And he just sort of takes it for granted that there is such a thing. So the way the narrow content literature used to work until I think Williamson pulled it in the direction of knowledge, which is also interesting, was people would just look at sort of wide content beliefs. So, you know, you believe that water is plentiful, but the identity conditions for that belief sort of depend on there being water out there in the world. And it might seem that you wanted a notion of belief that was neutral on what was out there in the world, because you might think, for example, you wanted a notion of belief that was suited for discussions of rationality and rational inference, and rational inference should not have a hostage to fortune out there in the world. And so one might try to say the following, you know, you believe that water is plentiful you narrowly believe that water is plentiful if you believe it, except there might not be any water. Or subtract the implication that there's water. And so that kind of attempt was made for a number of years. And I think what eventually happened was probably one of the first times it was realized that this maneuver is treacherous and has sort of presuppositions. If you think about, say, believing that water is plentiful, it's not clear that there aren't very many limits on what internal state you could be in and still be believing that water is plentiful. You could just be believing of anything that you catch sight of anywhere in the distance that it's plentiful, or that thing is unbeknownst to you, water. There isn't going to be any great intrinsic similarity between all the people who are looking out there in their environment and thinking that something or other is plentiful. But that's all you're left with if you try to get the narrow content by that wrapped. So generally speaking, what happens is either you can't subtract the thing you're supposed to at all, or when you do, you're left with much, much less than you had supposed. Yeah.
So to get back to how this fits into your subject matter analysis, how does the subtraction work there? How do you have it work?
Okay, so here's the connection. I talked about the part of a hypothesis about a certain subject matter, mm-hmm. M, call it. Subtraction is defined in a corresponding way as the part of hypothesis A that is not about a certain subject matter. I've got A, it's got an implication B. There's a subject matter of whether or not B, whether B is the case. And you can define in general, just as you can define what's left of A when you just focus on the part about a subject matter, you can also find what's left of A when you focus on the bit that isn't about a subject matter. And A minus B just is that portion of A which is silent on the issue of whether or not B. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole logical definition of how this works involving sort of humongous diagrams of logical space and more arrows than you could count. But that's the basic idea. So if you wanted to take away truth from knowledge, you'd say, well, what is the strongest implication of S knows that P, mm-hmm. that couldn't care, it's neutral on the issue of whether or not P. And there might or might not be a useful thing that remains. As in the Wittgenstein example, there probably isn't a useful thing that remains. And the idea that the intention could make up the difference is probably not right at all. But that's the kind of approach. So there's sort of parts about a subject matter, parts not about. Remainders, A minus B, are parts not about whether it's it's really not a part portion, not about whether be silent on the issue of whether or not be.
Right. Well, yeah. So silent on the issue is not quite not about.
Well, if the subject matter is whether or not be, that just is the issue. Yeah, so if it's silent on the issue of whether be, that's just the same as not being about the issue of whether be.
Okay.
Well, it's orthogonal. It's orthogonal.
Yeah. So I think we're running out of time. I just one last question, because we were, you mentioned knowledge, and one of the chapters in the book discusses a distinction between knowing that and knowing about. And so I was just maybe wondering if you could briefly say something about what you say about knowledge attributions that seem to care about subject matter above and beyond caring about truth conditions.
So here's an observation about counterexamples or reported counterexamples that have been given to closure of knowledge under known implication. They all involve an implication that brings in new subject matter. So, say, I am sitting by the fire. That implies that I'm not a bodiless brain in a vat. But, of course, I'm sitting by the fire isn't at all about bodies or brains in vats. Yeah. This is a zebra, so it's not a cleverly disguised mule. The conclusion brings in new subject matter. So that was sort of my entering wedge. Why is it you get failures of closure when new subject matter is brought in, but never, as far as I can tell, when the subject matter is contained? And the answer is supposed to be that, again, subject matter is kind of an amalgam of ways of being true and ways of being false. And without putting too fine a point on it, to know something involves knowing your way around its subject matter a little bit, which means, sort of in the case of the ways it could be false, doesn't really actually matter what the relation is that you postulate here. It all comes out the same, but maybe being on guard against those ways of being false, or being such that those ways of being false wouldn't explain how you came to believe that P, despite its being wrong. There's also knowing your way around the subject matter also involves not being too mixed up about why the belief is true, because truth makers play a role as well. Mm-hmm. And so in Gettier cases, you typically have somebody who's mixed up about why the belief is true. So I see some very weak structural conditions on what an account of knowledge would have to look like that have the consequence that any account of that form is going to find implications that introduce new subject matter potentially problematic, because to introduce new subject matter is something like introducing new ways of being true and new ways of being false. You could have been on top of all the old ways, but you're not on top of the new ways. So here's an example of Kripke's. He says, look, I know I locked the door. It follows from the fact that I locked the door that any evidence to the effect that I didn't lock the door is misleading. And so then it might seem, if you know that any evidence is misleading, you should just ignore whatever evidence comes along, though that's a further claim. So the subject matter of the first is, you know, whether I lock the door, something about me and the door. But the second is a whole different thing. It's about bodies of evidence that might be out there in the world. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have no idea what kind of evidence might be out there in the world against the hypothesis that I lock the door. But it would seem like I would need to have some idea that there wasn't too much of it, or it wasn't sort of overshadowed by the pro evidence, in order to feel like I could conscientiously claim to know that I locked the door. But this is how the problem arises. On the one hand, it would seem like I ought to have some control of this, because I don't want to be blindsided by huge amounts of evidence to the contrary I didn't think of, but I don't have any control over it. I have no idea what evidence there is. It's that feeling of disconnect from the new subject matter that creates the epistemic sort of unease that leads us to feel that we don't know, I think.
Huh. That's interesting. I'd like to pursue that, but I think we're sort of getting out of time now. So let me just ask a final question about what your next project is or what you're working on now.
I am thinking about relations between subject matter, desire, and conditionals, and a little bit obligation too, which has some of the same puzzling features. There's various sort of strange... This business about closure actually is very relevant to it. You know, you can desire something without desiring its consequences, or even things logically equivalent to it. So maybe my dog is lost, I want to find my dog. Finding my dog is finding my dog dead or alive. Those are the only two conditions a dog can be in. But I don't want to find my dog dead or alive.
Yeah.
Okay. So something to do with new issues being raised, the dead and the alive, carve up the same space differently, is going to affect your sense of what you sense of whether you still desire the thing. So I'm interested in the relations between sort of desire and the ways that the thing desired could obtain, and also things like obligation and the ways that the thing obliged could obtain, and permission. I mean, David Lewis raised this puzzle about permission many years ago. You know, suppose that I'm the boss and you're ordered to work all week, and then I say you can take Friday off, and Lewis says, well, look, I've permitted some worlds where you take Friday off, but which ones? Not ones where you take Friday off and use it to burn down the store. Not ones where you take Friday off and use it to break into my house. But somehow that's understood, but it's not clear how it's understood. And it's related to the notion that when you say a thing, there's certain ways for it to be true that are kind of pertinent and others that aren't pertinent. What I really would like to understand is how the line is drawn between pertinent ways for something to be true and ones that you would never think of and shouldn't think of, even though they really are ways for the thing to be true. And I think that relates to conditionals and desire, as I said, and also to stuff in deontic logic.
And grace, I would think, too, right? I mean, we only say the things that are enough.
Yeah, right.
In some way.
Yeah, and if you leave out words, the shorter the expression of the thought is, the more stereotypical the instance is supposed to be of what you're talking about. An example that I got from a linguist is, if I say, you say, where are you going? I say, I'm going to the school. That could be to the kid's school. It could be a school where I'm giving a talk, blah, blah, blah. But if I say, I'm going to school, I leave out the, right? So I'm giving you less clues about what's going on. Well, that tells you that it's a more stereotypical thing. I'm going to my school. I'm going to the school I always go to. And so that is, there's some kind of center of gravity for ways that things can happen that our thinking sort of is attracted to, that I think resolves a lot of the sort of what otherwise would be the sort of ambiguity in statements that people make. And I'm just interested in how that works.
Great. Well, I think we should, we'll probably have to close this now, but I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us about your new book.
Thanks a lot for asking, and thanks for the great questions.
Okay, bye-bye.
So long.
You've been listening to an interview with Stephen Yablo, professor of philosophy at MIT, about his new book, Aboutness, just out from Princeton University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.